Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Mark. Delighted to have you today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I do not know each other. I think we figured out that we've met on LinkedIn and probably exchanged some messages. You probably commented on something. I don't really know, but we're going to get to know each other here and hopefully create some value for our listeners. Before we dive into our topic of conversation, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Mark Hensrud. I work for Minnesota State University Moorhead in Moorhead, Minnesota. Been in fundraising for 10 years. Started off at a small nonprofit little Bible camp in northeastern North Dakota, then moved into the higher education world. I was at a private school for about 4.5 years and came to my alma mater 3.5 years ago. So I've been at MSUM for 3.5 years. So August of 17.
Yeah. So the book project that I wrapped up a couple of years ago that I'm oftentimes talking about with my guests, I was writing to somebody who was about 10 years in, like you're describing. And that individual was that person who'd sort of very intentionally decided that fundraising worked for them, but they were sort of beyond the fundraising 101. I can't go to any more conferences and sit in a, you know, direct, how to do direct mail, how to plan special events, all that sort of shit. You just got totally tired of, right? Yeah. My guess is that you're 10 years in, you're figuring out, Mark, that this work is actually meaningful work. You want to be recognized and admired for doing meaningful work. And perhaps you're thinking more critically about what it is you're doing. Am I right?
Yeah, you're spot on.
Yeah, yeah. That's essentially what this podcast is all about. We like to get on here, ask big ideas, talk about big ideas, bold opinions. We always ask our listeners to, I mean, our guests to come on here with a big idea, bold opinion. What you got for us?
Well, you know, thanks once again for inviting me to come on, Jason. There's a variety of big ideas out there. I've heard a couple of folks talking on your podcast, and I appreciate the insight that they've given me.
Yeah.
One thing that I want to talk about is planned giving. You know, in my opinion, planned giving is easy. Okay. When I first got into it, I was I was just drowning in everything that there was with planned giving, from trusts, from you know, IRA distributions through RMDs. But a majority of the gifts that are coming in are very simple. You know, we have, I would say 90-95% of our planned gifts come through estates, and it's just a simple beneficiary designation.
Have you found out, have you figured out, that's certainly the point that you're making, at what point, because I know where you're at with that thought, at what point did you sort of realize that the highly technical sort of master technician at planned giving really wasn't what it required to get the job done? Isn't that essentially what you're getting at? That, you know, tinkering around with the engine, with tools and all those sorts of things, like my father would as a mechanic, isn't really what planned giving is. I remember being in some of those workshops earlier in my career where you'd sit there and they would, I mean, they'd give you all these acronyms and all this, you know, language and stuff. And at the end of the day, you're like, you know what? I've got to build a relationship with this individual, and all of that's going to be, can be secondary to the fact that I've got to be able to sit in this room with this individual and perhaps talk about sort of late in life sort of decisions. And if I can't just understand the, you know, what he or she cares about and know the names of her grandchildren or something, this ain't going anywhere. Am I right?
Yeah. You know, it brings me back to when I was at the private school, we had a fundraiser who would fundraise for 50 years. He was a type of individual who knew everybody, knew their kids, knew their grandkids. You would go to him for any questions you had about anything fundraising, but he really loved planned giving. But he understood it in a way that I never got. And I just felt like he was getting too far into the weeds on certain things. Yes, there are times when you need to call in an expert, but for a majority of folks, you don't need that. We went and visited with this bachelor farmer. And this bachelor farmer wanted to give us everything. And all of a sudden we started talking about, well, you're still alive, but you could do a, you know, a deed transfer right now. And by doing this, you could have these tax, you know, changes and implications. And I'm like, whoa, let's calm down. What is he trying to do? He's trying to give us stuff. Let's not make it any harder than it needs to be, because he's really passionate about our cause. And we're now putting these hurdles to have him start thinking in other ways. And what happens if we throw too many hurdles at him? Is he going to start directing dollars elsewhere? It ended up not happening. And you know, the college ended up receiving a very generous gift, but we just kept it as simple as possible for him. And that's all that he wanted.
There's an author, I can't think of his name, but there's an author that I read. Actually, I think he's a poet. And he, for some reason, he writes poetry about the workplace. And it's really deep stuff. I want to say his last name's White or something. But one of the things he talks about is that the idea that the conversation is the work. That's the idea, that the conversation is the work. And I think that's something that plagues that notion that the conversation in and of itself is where the work is getting done. So you sitting in that gentleman's living room and having a meaningful conversation with him, and perhaps knowing how to sit there for 45 minutes to an, I mean, I've been there. I've been in that gentleman's driveway. I've been in those living rooms. I've experienced that, where the work of doing this type of fundraising that you and I are talking about is really to sort of put all that quote unquote expertise that we have, that oftentimes is very necessary. And especially when you're talking about planned gifts, sophisticated planned gifts, is to actually just sort of hold that back. Right. I mean, you don't want to show all your cards. You're not in a quote unquote sales posture. You just want to build a genuine relationship. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jason. One of the it takes me back to a conversation that I'd had with a couple of donors, and one of them was an alum of our institution. Another one was from somewhere else. As we were talking, they have no children, and the first thing that came out of their mouths, they said to me, without even knowing, I'm saying, "Hey, we don't have a lot of money."
Right.
So don't expect anything big.
Yeah.
And after spending an hour with them and then following up with a handful of phone conversations, we ended up doing $100,000 charitable gift annuity.
Yeah.
Because I found out that, you know what, they have all this money. They don't, have any children to give it to, but they just want to make sure that they're financially stable throughout the rest of their life, but they also want to make an impact now. And so by listening to those conversations with them and being able to understand where they want to go, I was able to talk to that and talk to them about that particular type of gift. And after I had established that relationship in the midst of the pandemic this past June,
yeah,
the American Council on Gift Annuities decided that they were going to be decreasing rates. So I called them up again and just said, hey, just so you're aware, if you want to do another one, the rates are going to drop. But I'd already established that relationship over the course of a couple of years. And they did another 100,000 in the midst of a pandemic.
What do you think? What do you think it is about our profession? I oftentimes say here on the podcast that fundraising is in the midst of its messy adolescence. So it just hasn't, we haven't collectively grown up enough to know that the conversation, the building of the relationship is the work. And so we're always sort of grasping for other things to sort of be legitimate in our own heads. What is it, do you think, that is it just because we're a young profession and we haven't done this for, you know, as a society and as a culture, we haven't been fundraisers for, you know, perhaps centuries. We've only say done it for two or three generations now. Or is there something else that makes us sort of always seem to be great? It's like, you remember when we were in middle school and high school, right in the middle of adolescence, you're always grasping for things that make you feel like you're legitimate in the world. Right. And so sometimes it's these metaphors that I hear being used about sales and marketing and advertising. It's like, why can't we just do the work that we do? Why do we always have to sort of compare ourselves? That's what we did in high school when we were sort of insecure and pimply faced and all that sort of stuff. What do you think it is about fundraising that sort of causes us to do that sort of stuff?
I think some people are ashamed that they're going out and asking for money. Like, they're becoming beggars.
Yeah.
And I completely disagree with that sentiment. You know, there's a book, and I'm not trying to pitch anything, but I have it right here. It's a book called The Spirituality of Fundraising by Henry Nouwen.
Yeah, probably one of the best ones you can read it early in your career. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so it was the first one that I picked up, and it goes into a variety of things about how if we look at these people who have significant assets, or even who don't have significant assets, but if we're viewing money as evil and we just can't get past that, or we think that they might not have made their money in a ethical way, you know, we're putting them being the donors into a position that we shouldn't be putting them into, because we're there to come alongside of them and work with those folks. And so I'm going to butcher the quote, but I think how you and I got connected, now that I think about it, was through this.
Oh, book. Yeah, those guys. You know, yeah. Yep, those are my buddies. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so within the first, you know, first couple pages, I'm just going to quick look at it here. I it's within the first chapter. It's not just about the donor. It's The Ultimate Management Guide to Major Gift and Success by Richard Perry and Jeff Schrieffels. I saw you commented about that on LinkedIn. I'm like, "Oh, I'll check it out." So anyway, one of the things that they had mentioned within the first chapter is you being the fundraiser are a broker of love.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, and if we start looking at fundraising like that, and we can talk about helping people make these transformational gifts instead of transactional gifts, and having people start understanding that, you know what, we can give from our assets and not just our checkbooks. That's where these bigger gifts come from. And we understand that that this type of love, by giving back to our fellow, you know, man, whether it's through university or a pet shelter or you name it, that's how we're going to improve the world. And I feel that fundraisers have a vital part of that moving forward.
Yeah, you know, Jeff and Richard at the Veritas Group are good friends of mine. They for the sake of our listeners who are not watching this on YouTube,
this is on YouTube too, huh?
Yeah, this is on YouTube, man. That's why we got the camera.
I just thought you wanted to see my pretty face.
No, man, this is YouTube too, man. That's their new book, and they have the Major Gift Academy, but they're really good friends. And you know, that first chapter in their book, he talks about how this work is spiritual work. And for guys like you and me, people like you and I who've done work in that parachurch space, you know, we're okay with that spirituality. But what Jeff and Richard talk about in their book is that we don't have to over-spiritualize or make this about sort of religiosity sort of lingo. Like, you know, we don't have to go that far. Yeah. You can be working for an organization that's not necessarily a faith-based organization, and you can sort of see that sort of spiritual journey. And if you got to take the spirituality up, it's sort of that self, it's sort of that place that we want to, that self-actualization is what, you know, when we talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and stuff, a lot of times the people who are giving these planned gifts that you're talking about, they've sort of arrived at a place where there's a lot of other needs that they've already sort of taken care of in their life. You know, the mortgage is paid off, the kids have gone to college, all these other things. You're not talking about a planned gift at 35 years old. You're talking about a planned gift oftentimes at like 65, 70 years old. And so they're achieving sort of a growth, a maturity, a wisdom, a place in life where it's a spiritual journey for them, because that's the needs that we have at that age. And what Jeff and Richard are talking about in that book is it's oftentimes if you're on the other side of that exchange, it's largely the same thing. But, you know, Mark, I've got to get you to, because we haven't talked about Nowen's book a whole lot on the podcast. And as somebody who's done a lot of fundraising in the faith-based space, I've always been a big fan of that very simple book that that I recommend to anyone, whether they're in a faith-based organization or not. But it's that notion that that Nowen talks about how we discriminate. He talks about how we inadvertently discriminate against the poor, I mean, the rich, in much the same way that we would be offended if we saw someone discriminate against the poor, because we look at them and we say, okay, they've got money, and so all their needs are met. And it's a really difficult thing for us. I think that's one of the challenges when we talk about why fundraising is so difficult. It's because we don't understand that, yes, with all these needs that these individuals have already got met, because yes, they are affluent, they've got power, they've got all these sorts of things, they're still just a living, breathing human being who just has needs that perhaps by actually giving away these resources, what John Wesley would have talked about how, you know, you let the entrepreneurs sort of generate it all up so that they can now shovel it back out. There's that shoveling out process that has to happen in order for a person to sort of reach those ultimate places in life. And if we just look at these people as ATM machines, if we just exploit them for what's in their checking account, it's in many ways a form of oppression is sort of what Nowen sort of alludes to. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it brings me back to, I love telling stories. I'm a fundraiser. I apologize for that. But there's a gentleman who I've gotten to know. He's the head of a big company. And as we were talking over the course of the years, we were going to be recognizing this individual and on our campus. And this particular individual had come straight out and said, I just want to know, are you expecting something from me because I'm getting this? Yeah, almost like a quid pro quo. And so I said, you know, I'm going to call him John.
John, yeah.
He's not sure. John. But you know, John, we appreciate all that you've done. And you've clearly done extremely well within the career that you've chosen. And we want to recognize you for that behalf. If for some reason you want to give back, we want you to be able to do so. But we want it to be from your heart and not, not because you feel like you have to, because you're receiving this particular award. And so, so we talked a little bit more about transactional versus transformational, yeah, which I'd already mentioned and what that means. And I think there's kind of a sense of relief that, you know, we're not giving you this award because we expect you to name a building. Yeah. If you did, we would love it. I'm not saying don't do that, but, this is a great book. It truly is.
We're going to be,
and it's very, it's very short.
I think you can download it. I think you can. I think we could probably attach a PDF version that's out there. We'll attach.
Yeah, probably.
We're talking about Henry Nowen's Spirituality of Fundraising, but there's sort of another piece to this that I think, you know, Nowen is writing to now in his writing to us, the person on the sort of the receiving side. And I think that's what I've oftentimes said to organizations is it's that receiving that sort of offends us. You know, when we talk about fundraising, oftentimes we're in these rooms and we're always more than happy to talk about generosity and giving and sort of all that feel good stuff that sort of comes with, being on the giving side. Right. And that's what the donor is being given the opportunity to do. And I think some of the reasons that we struggle with this legitimacy sort of issue in our work is oftentimes because we just don't know how to receive. You know, we don't know how to sort of be in this posture without feeling totally inferior. You know, we always feel like, and so I think we have to learn how to sort of be on a level playing field with, like, say, John, and not feel like we're sort of in this supplicant sort of, you know, woe is me, please solve all my problems. But we also have to sort of have the confidence and the willingness to sort of receive and to sort of be a vehicle. I like to talk about it as a sort of like a bridge between those that have and those that have not. That's essentially what fundraisers are. But you're in the receiving posture. You know, I think that's one of the reasons that I think we struggle in this space, too, with supervisors. I oftentimes say that fundraisers, I don't think we have a fundraiser problem. I think we have a supervisor problem. You ever sort of experience that sort of working with that board member or that boss who just isn't as comfortable with this process as a guy like you or I would have because you just haven't been in the field. You haven't been in front of John or Sally or Sue enough to sort of know that, hey, this is okay to sort of play out this way, to have that. I had a client once, Mark. I went on this meeting and I asked the donor a question, and my client was just sort of mesmerized that we could even have the conversation of the sort you're describing with John, right?
Yeah, my first gig as a fundraiser, I essentially helped create the position, and I'm going to apologize right now. We have a UPS coming up and I have two dogs. So, okay. So my dogs are likely going to be going
That's
up.
Okay.
Here, one second. I'll do that. Once the doorbell rings, it'll be a different story.
Yeah. I've got a dog that's asleep right there, and the mail doesn't come for another hour or so. So
yeah. Anyway, so I essentially created this first fundraising job that I'd had. And when I got into that role, I had never done fundraising. I had done sales, and I was successful in sales, but it was with this small Bible camp that I talked about, a place that I was extremely passionate about. And I thought, yeah, if I can sell something, why can't I raise money for this? And one of the executive board members made a comment. He said, just so you know, we're hiring you to raise money. Because that's not us. I'm like, well, you know what? You understand that you being on the executive, you know, part of the board, people are going to want to hear from you before they want to hear from a 25-year-old kid talking about a camp. You know, but no, we hired you, so don't expect us to ask for money. You know, that's all on you. And so going from that into the place where I am now, and I had no supervisor besides the executive director who didn't have fundraising experience either. So then going into the university system, you know, and being able to see, like I had mentioned earlier with the gentleman who had fundraised for 50 years, you know, see what he had done and how he does things, but then also understand that the board is very willing to help out. So it's, you know, two differences, you know, with a, you know, foundation that's been around for quite a while and they understand what fundraising is to a brand new, you know, figure it out by yourself fundraising of one shop. So,
yeah, I just recently had a guest on here. We were talking about, she's the head of school at an all girls school in California. And she has made the transition from a fundraising role to the CEO role and now hiring her first development officer, you know, her first chief development officer now in this senior executive sort of role. And we were talking about the idea that I think we're going to see as this, as our profession continues to mature, we're going to see more and more individuals like yourself who have sort of been in the trenches, and you're not going to have the same sort of professional sort of trajectory as that individual, for example, that board member who sort of says, this is all about you and you're going to do all of this. You're going to have an appreciation of sort of what it means to be in the trenches, what it means to get this job done. And I think what's most exciting, this is what I'm getting at here. I think what most excites me, and I meet these people all the time, oftentimes in these conversations, is I think when we're when we start to see people like yourself transitioning into the senior executive roles, and then you're hiring development officers yourself, you're going to be a better supervisor of these people because you've done it yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, going back to your reference to sales, we know this in the sales world too. Most high-achieving salespeople, and I don't know why we don't, for as much as we talk about sales in this space, I don't know why we don't take this into consideration. But one of the things we know about high-achieving salespeople is that they want to work for people who know how to do what it is they're doing. It's like you and I playing on the baseball field or something. We want to be able to offer each other constructive criticism. I don't want you to just pat me on the back because I hit the ball out of the park. I want you to be able to actually look at how I hit that ball and tell me that that swing might have been a little off or something. And so just giving me a pat on the back because I come back to the office with a $50,000 check and you bringing out the maracas and having a party for me isn't really the feedback that a high achieving individual wants. And I think that's what our sector right now is struggling with, is we got a bunch of bosses around who just basically want to bring out the maracas and pat Mark on the back. That's not what they want. I think you want a boss who actually says, hey, how could we have done that differently? Did we move too fast? Was it particularly strategic? And in some ways, you want that boss to not even necessarily be, you want them to go out into the field with you, not for the obligation to ask for the gift, but just to actually be out there with you and sort of, explore the, am I right?
Yeah, having two sets of ears is always helpful. We have within our foundation, we have an executive director, a manager, a principal, major gifts, and then development folks. We're a smaller shop. We have five fundraisers, and then we have folks in our annual giving portion of the foundation and stewardship and things like that. But overall, we're a pretty small foundation. But yeah, anytime you can get a few people out there, you have more sets of ears. They might hear something that I didn't pick up on because I wasn't listening. I was trying to think of what I was going to say next, which I try not to do, but it tends to happen. With everybody, you're thinking, geez, well, what's going to make that donor go to the next step? What should I say instead of actually paying attention? But then at the same time, if you do bring in a big gift, yeah, exactly like you said, Jason, man, good job. Nice work. What did you do? What things worked, what things didn't, how can we kind of tweak things going forward? Is there a particular program that or something that they said that really resonated with you that kind of brought you to that next step to say, hey, you know what, this is the area that I think that they're going to be passionate about. So yeah, it's great to have the maracas and come out and say good job, but also doing some self-reflecting and having a conversation with the team to help the team understand too, because we're all traveling to different parts of the U.S., donors are the same everywhere, right? But at the same time, what is a type A personality going to be like compared to a type B?
Yeah.
If there's somebody who's out there and just said, no, let's get straight to the point, how does that differ from going into a conversation where it's a time sucker? You know what I mean? It sounds bad, but they just want to talk and you spend 3 hours with them.
Has it ever, one of the things I'm working on with this new writing project right now is this idea of, because of the association, everybody knows that listens to this regularly, I've got a real hang up with the idea that fundraising oftentimes gets pushed into this box with sales and marketing and PR and all this sort of consumer oriented thinking. And I, in my research, I have figured out that it's no coincidence that since the Industrial Revolution, since the beginning of the 20th century, we've basically become this. And this isn't my brilliance figuring out. This is all well documented. We basically become a consumer society where we basically see each other. The only way we can sort of see each other is basically those who are buying and selling goods and services. We're all consumers. So whether we're thinking about who we're going to elect in Washington, whether we think about how we're going to give to a charitable organization, the person in John's seat is a consumer in our mind. And I think in some ways that's part of that. I think that's part of that insecurity that we sort of have built up too, is we don't know how to, going back to your talking about how you started, you came into this from a sales background. At some point, you got to sort of get on the, you got to get on the other side of buying and selling stuff to people. You know, I think fundraising is in the way that you started off with the idea of, say, planned giving, for example. Look, man, if you don't get to sell this person a widget, if you don't actually put something tangible in their hands, that's far harder work. That's far harder work than sales. You know, I mean, a transaction is a transaction. I mean, my coffee cup here, I can actually put something tangible in your hand and you can give me a, you know, some sort of exchange in return for that particular cup of coffee. But that's not really what we're doing in fundraising. Am I right?
Right. Yeah. And you know, going back to the planned giving, you know, we can't take anything with us when we pass away. And so you're not going to be getting anything, you know, maybe a society recognition, you know, being a part of a legacy society or a founder society or you name it. Or if you give X number of dollars, you can hit a certain society. But that's not why they're giving to join those societies.
Yeah.
It's because they want to do something with the hard-earned dollars that they had made for good. You know, there's an organization that does some, you know, we had talked a little bit about going to conferences. And one of the first conferences that I attended, it was the second conference that I'd attended. It was the, it was through Advancement Resources.
Yeah, yeah.
We went down to Denver, and one of the first things that the one thing that they wanted to drill into your head as a fundraiser was talking about money. But, you know, what do you want to do? Speaking to the donor, what do you want to do with your money that would be meaningful to you?
Yeah.
And that's the one question that they wanted us to remember. And so, it isn't a transaction. It's a transformation.
Yeah.
And I know it's kind of cliche. You hear about that, but yeah, it's not a tangible item that you're getting.
You've been in the faith-based space. You've gotten in Advancement Resources wouldn't have been that in that space, but all of my initial training, for example, would have been with faith-based organizations, you know, faith-based fundraisers. I think one of the things that faith-based fundraisers make the mistake of because they sort of, they overly insert or they too soon that notion that it doesn't belong to us. Right. That's, you know, anybody in the sort of traditional Judeo-Christian sort of space understand that notion that it doesn't belong to us. Right. But that's that realization that perhaps the donor hasn't come to can only be sort of experienced when they relinquish control of it, when they give it over to someone else and they don't do it in exchange for something like my cup of coffee. You know, if I'm not buying something. So in some ways, and this gets back to Jeff and Richard's book. And what I think is the mistake that a lot of institutions who would not see themselves as being quote unquote religious organizations or faith-based organizations, oftentimes generosity of the sort that you and I want to arrive at, especially when it comes to a planned gift, those decisions are rooted in some sort of faith tradition somewhere. That's where generosity is oftentimes taught. And I think we've got to, in the nonprofit sector, sort of reconcile that, even as we try to be deliberately secular or sort of separate from the church, which I think in some ways is a problem. In that we miss the opportunity to sort of really grasp why John's making that decision to make that planned gift, because he or she is trying to get to that place where they actually know what it means for it not to belong to them. you know? Mm-hmm. And so by me surrendering this gift that I genuinely want to believe in my own expression of whatever faith journey I've been on, by me surrendering it to you and you not giving me something back, even if it means not putting my name up on the side of the building, I think that's one of the errors that we make by putting people's names on the side of buildings is we're essentially selling them something, right? So whether you're selling them a tote bag, whether you're selling them a tote bag in exchange for $25 or whether you're, you know, putting their name on a side of a building for $1 million, either way, you're still doing some sort of exchange for something. I don't think either individual really wants that when they're at the place where you're having a conversation of the one like you're having with John or Sally. Am I right?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah. 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 Where are you going to be in 10 years? I'm interested. You're 10 years in. So before I let you go, where are you going to be in 10 years?
Well, that's a great question, Jason.
I ask this because your journey thus far has been very similar to mine. I was raised in the church. I went to summer camp. My second fundraising job was at a camp organization. They didn't know what the hell they were doing either. And I worked for that bozo who didn't want to have anything to do with fundraising. It's interesting the way you describe that. So I may be 10, 15 years ahead of you at the most. Where are you going to be in 10 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love where I'm at. I love continuing to learn.
Yeah.
One of the things that I want to do in 2021, I'm not going to call it a resolution because I think that you should just set goals and not say, well, I hope I do this. One of the things that I want to do is really dive into more books. I'm an awful reader. I just don't give myself the time and space to do it. You know, we have two young kids. My wife's working full time too. And, so I need to be able to, I want to read more often. And so that's the reason why I picked up that book, by Richard and Jeff.
Yeah.
And I'm two chapters into it. So I'm still there, but, I want to continue to learn more about the profession.
Yeah.
I think that, if 10 years from now, I'm in the exact same seat that I'm in right now, I'll be happy.
Yeah.
If we're doing well from a, you know, from a foundation standpoint, and I'm a part of that team that has helped us get there and I'm still here. Great. You could ask me what I want to do in a year and I couldn't tell you, you know, I'm 37 years old.
Right.
I'm 37 years old. I can't answer that about 10 years. All I know is I want to dive into this profession more because it's something that I care deeply about. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've told myself, as I've gotten into the fundraising space, if I'm going to be asking donors for a gift, you know, significant or not, I need to be putting my money where my mouth is too. And so I want to look at what a significant gift is from our standpoint. And I want to make sure that I'm at that level too, from a giving standpoint. And so we view a major gift as being $5,000 annually.
Yeah.
I'm not making $5,000 contributions to our organization. I don't have that type of money, but I'm making $1,000.
Yeah.
You know, it's a small little thing that I can say, you know what, I believe in this enough to be asking for it. But if I'm not putting my own money where I feel passionate about, or I'm requesting those dollars for, then I think that we're missing out on something because I can't see the impact that my money has if I'm not giving, but I'm asking for it. If that makes sense.
It does. It makes perfect sense. If I could recommend a book to you, actually I'll recommend two of them. There's a great book. Neither of these are fundraising books, but, and I'd certainly recommend them to any of our listeners. I'll put some links in the show notes. Obviously, in addition to, coincidentally, we've been talking about, Richard and Jeff's new book. We'll put a link in there for those guys at Veritas as well. But there's a book by a guy named David Epstein called Range. And Range is talking about what happens in our society now is this notion of early specialization. And early specialization is this idea that he calls it a cult. And I think fundraising is plagued right now with this early specialization problem where we can, within a matter of 5 years, you can sort of pigeonhole yourself as a specialist in a way that allows you to sort of prevent yourself from ever interacting with a donor in a meaningful way. You know, if you think of the normal trajectory of a fundraising development officer, he or she oftentimes ends up in a place where they learn how to do this, what I call arm's length fundraising stuff, galas, golf tournaments, grant writing, direct mail. Those are all things you learn in the first couple of years. You can become a rock star if that stuff within 5 years. You can be credentialed. You can have your CFRE. You can do all that. You can basically plateau if you want to. And I think our profession, and I know there's a lot of people out there who disagree with me, and they're probably, you know, shifting in their seat and saying, like, why the hell is this guy saying this? He's hurting my feelings. But that's exactly what Epstein's talking about in his book, is that we have early specialized now in a society that doesn't want all these specialists running around. We don't need specialists. We need generalists out there. And in a context like we're in now, where you've got to learn how to use technology, for example, to essentially do what is a major gift, like what you and I are doing here this morning, isn't any different than sitting in John's living room. You know, we're having a meaningful conversation. Yeah, the technology is great, but this technology is only going to get better. And your ability to have that meaningful conversation is just, you're just going to have to jump in. And direct mail and galas and golf tournaments isn't going to teach you how to do that. Something along the lines, I recommend this to my students over at the college. It's a book called Deep Work. Deep Work is written by a guy named Cal Newport. And what Deep Work talks about, it's something kind of along the same lines of what Epstein's talking about, Mark. But he's talking about how our society has gotten to the place where we only value collectively that work that is deep work. So if it can be done highly efficiently, if it can be automated, so all this fear that things are going to get automated and robots are going to be doing our job one day or not. Think about where you started here with planned giving. I can outsource and automate pretty much all of the initial gifts that an organization can get, right? I can get it through galas, golf tournaments, direct mail, and I can largely outsource that to somebody else, or I can let a volunteer do it. But at some point,
yeah, phone-a-thoning, you can outsource phone-a-thoning.
Yeah, yep. All that stuff. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I have to have somebody on my payroll who knows how to call up John and say, John, thanks for that gift. And let me lean into a conversation with you and let me not feel like I have to close the deal today. Let me drive out to your farm, have a meaningful conversation with you, not feel like I got to close a deal that day. That's what this guy Newport would call deep work. And what he's saying in his book is that our society will not pay for in any meaningful way. If you want to look at who we're going to pay in this profession, top dollars, it's not going to change. We still pay, and we always have, and we always will. We will always pay those people who have the most meaningful relationships with our donors more money than those who don't. Mm-hmm. And I think... I mean, I appreciate that you brought to the conversation planned giving, but I also appreciate that you brought to the conversation Jeff and Richard's book, as well as Nowen's book, because your ability at 10 years in to sort of know that I've got to get in front of John, I've got to get in front of Sally, I've got to have a meaningful conversation is really what it's all about. It sounds to me like that those opportunities you had earlier in your career, now where you're at 10 years in, is largely sort of getting you there. Am I right?
Yeah. And, you know, and not being afraid to pick up the phone and setting those appointments, you know, that's one of the keys to being successful. And now with the, you know, current pandemic, and like you said, with technology, the way that it is, you know, I've set up, once again, I'm living in North Dakota. I work for a organization in Minnesota. I'm not going to hop on a plane and I'm meeting with people in Texas, right. In 2 weeks. Yeah. I'm meeting with somebody in Arizona tomorrow, you know, tomorrow. And it's going to be face to face, just like this. Is there a place for that? And for phone conversations? Yeah, absolutely. I think I can see organizations saving some money on travel and expenses because you're able to do this more often, but there is still something about being, you know, in person with somebody. And, but yeah, you have to have those meaningful conversations and the thank yous. And I'm going to leave it with this one, Jason. It's kind of funny. You were talking about driving out to the farm. I have to throw some type of Scandinavian goodies in here. You know, for our holiday season, what we would do for our board members and for donors within our region that we can easily access by driving. We bring out Lefse. We bring out Lefse to our donors, and just as a thank you, and that's it.
You're gonna have to tell me. Tell me. I'm sure you can see it on my face. I don't know what you're talking about. You're gonna tell me what you're talking about. I've never even heard that term. I'm not ashamed. I'm not a guy who's ashamed to tell you when I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
So imagine like a flour tortilla or burrito, or it's a potato. It's a, and there's a process behind it. And, you can get into the different Scandinavian areas saying, well, what do you put on to Lefse? I'm a traditionalist. I just do butter and sugar, and that's it. We have people who throw lutefisk in, and I'm not a lutefisk lover. We have folks who do brown sugar as opposed to white sugar. What we do is we bring these out and just say thank you. And most recently when I did this a couple of weeks ago, somebody handed me an envelope, and it was a $300,000 planned gift because I had talked to them previously and they filled out the paperwork and just said, oh, you're coming by here. Why don't I fill this out for you? And just gave it to me. I didn't open it until I got back to the office, but and it's not because I brought them Lefse, but
yeah, you're talking about, I'm hearing you correctly, you're talking about a cultural sensitivity and a cultural awareness that you share with your donors that allows you to bring a very, very simple, it sounds like you're talking about a Scandinavian, basically tortilla, right? It's basically like a biscuit or something, right? But what your awareness is that all the Sallys and the Johns in your world are probably culturally speaking, probably eating this stuff. And it's the simple awareness that you sort of demonstrate by bringing because if you're not, I'm guessing you buy this stuff at the grocery store. Yeah. So I'm gonna have to go ask my wife. I'll go ask Erica to bake some of this stuff or whatever. I'm fascinated. I have Norwegian roots. My mother's Norwegian, and were Norwegians eat this stuff as well?
Oh yeah. I'm primarily Norwegian.
Okay.
So it's a Scandinavian, Norwegians, the Swedes.
Fascinating.
It all depends on. Yeah. So if you're primarily Norwegian, then I'm not a lutefisk fan, like I said, but some people throw lutefisk in.
Okay, fascinating.
And I was told to make sure to not drop too many oh sure you betchas in there for us up in the Midwest, but I have to do one because who doesn't love the show or the movie Fargo? Right.
Yes, yes. I have four kids, and I've yet to get them to sit down. It's a long film. When you told me where you were from, I was thinking, I reminded myself, I keep trying to get my kids to sit down and watch Fargo with me. It's definitely a film that you could watch. I think the first time I watched it was probably when I was in my early 20s. But it's a good film. So, I had somebody on the podcast recently tell me, one of the things about people in the upper Midwest is that you guys get along better with people because you know what it means to live sort of in the winter months. And so you can't, this is a day after the inauguration. You think about all this unity that was talked about yesterday and the polarization. We're totally going off on a tangent here as we wrap up.
That's fine.
But he was basically talking about how people, because I told him, I said, there's something about, we were actually talking about Nebraska and Iowa. You guys are even further north. You mean you're much further north than those guys. But he said, we've got really hard winters. And so when you got really hard winters, you're fighting with the environment. You're fighting it. Your challenges are the environment, not the neighbor, right? So you can't be at odds with your neighbor. So if your neighbor voted for somebody else, it's not to your advantage in the middle of January to sort of hate their guts. And because I said, every time I talk to somebody in the upper Midwest, they seem, Minnesota is an example. Some of those people just strike me as people who just know how to get along with people who don't look like them. Right. I mean, despite the obviously tragic events that happened back last summer, but despite that, it just seems like some of your neighbors, you and your neighbors seem to get along pretty well with us in the Mid-Atlantic. We're kind of a messy mix of people. I'm from the South. So
you just need to slow down. I mean, I feel like people especially on the East Coast, is just, got to go quick. And just take your time. Right. I had my speed when I was in high school, where I got caught going 100 miles an hour on gravel in my pickup. And, ever since then, I'm like, you know what? There's more to life than speed. You know, just kind of slow down, take your time, enjoy the surroundings, enjoy the people. I'm doing more. You know, at 37 years old, I'm doing some nice Sunday drives, you know, just, you know, casually going out. But yeah, no, it's if you can't get along with your neighbors, if you can't get along with people, it's going to be a tough road to hoe.
Yeah, no kidding. So, hey, brother, it's been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. I'm going to stop the record, but don't go anywhere.
All right.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.